If you haven't already, explore the many ways to connect with our show. Watch full uncut conversations on YouTube, gain AIA-approved continuing education credits through Arcademy, and make sure to check us out and follow us on social media at Detailed Podcast. This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com.
I've always wanted to design one of these, and so we're finally designing one, which is a camera obscura. They're very low-tech, medieval. They're really from the medieval period, which are just basically a black room with a little hole, and you can see the outside pictured on certain surfaces depending on how you design that little hole. So this beacon will actually have a couple of these camera obscuras where you, as you walk or take the elevator up, you can see the outside projected on the inside of a room. And then, of course, that beacon is illuminated at night and becomes kind of like a big monument and a landmark.
This is Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. I am your host, Charisse Lakeside, senior specification writer at RDH Building Science and fondly known as the CSI Kraken. We will speak with professionals who share their insights into the most complex, interesting, and odd building conditions and the ingenuity it took to make it work. Join me as I pull back the curtain on the building industry and uncover the lessons learned. You'll gain valuable knowledge to help you better navigate your next project. My guest today is Carlos Arnaiz, principal at CAZA, that's C-A-Z-A, in Brooklyn, New York. Carlos is an architect, educator, writer, and urban design consultant. He is the founder of CAZA, co-founder of CERBA, S-U-R-B-A, and an adjunct assistant professor at Pratt Institute's Graduate School of Architecture and Urban Design. His work spans large-scale mixed-use complexes in strategic sustainability plans for cities worldwide. He holds a master's degree with honors from Harvard GSD and a bachelor's degree, magna cum laude, from Williams College. The project we're talking about today is the Shoreside Nawin, N-A-W-I-N, in Nasugbu Bay, Philippines. But before we get started, don't forget to take a look at the project photos and drawings as you listen along. You can click the link in our show notes or visit www.rcat.com/podcast. Set against the rugged cliffs of Batangas in the Philippines, the Shoreside at Nawin reimagines the dialogue between land and sea through an architecture deeply attuned to its terrain and cultural setting. Envisioned as a contemporary port town, the project transforms a once industrial coastline into a walkable, multi-layered community where hospitality, ecology, and coastal heritage intersect.
You know, one of the first things I tell people about this project is you got to know who the client is, because they brought to the project a very unique vision. And first of all, they're not one group, but they are really a consortium. It's a group of local business people who have been involved in real estate and property development, but that's not their forte. They're in finance, they're in hospitality, they're in fact, pharmaceuticals. One of them is the owner of the largest privately held pharmaceutical company in Southeast Asia, with factories all throughout the region. So they're quite diversified. And because I think they work in different industries, they brought to the project a unique vision that wasn't what normal, I think, real estate developers would do. It's probably not news to your listeners who are in the industry of architecture and design that, you know, real estate is a rather risk-averse industry, and which means that they typically favor solutions that have worked previously. And for real estate developers to think outside of the box normally requires them to be very creative, maybe younger, maybe stupid. And, you know, they kind of go, and because of all of those things mixed together, they do something innovative. In this case, these guys are not stupid, but they are out from other industries and said, why don't we do it this way? And so what they wanted to do was to create the first marina town with all the amenities and all the experiences that you would have in a marina town that you might see in the south of France or on the coast of Turkey or you know, in the Caribbean. But here in this archipelago of 7,000 islands in the Philippines, which is, interestingly enough, doesn't have such a thing. I mean, if you look at the history of, you know, the Philippines is, of course, a island, you know, it's an archipelago with a population that's always had a relationship to water, fishing, farming, aquaculture. But their relationship to water has many times been industrial, has not really been recreational. It's been a place to work. So if you look at the traditional towns in the Philippines, and you go to the coast, along the waters where they have the fishing boats, and the towns actually face inward. The towns don't really look to the water, because the water was where people went to work, and then when they left the ocean, they went in many times also to protect themselves from the storms, to be away from the water where you have surges and you have more unpredictable elements. So facing the water is kind of a new thing. It's a thing of the 21st century, thinking of it as a place of leisure, relaxation. That's something that's, in a way, strangely enough, if you think, it hasn't ever been done. So this would be the first. And hopefully, you know, it will also, you know, it's coming at a time where the country has experienced, you know, economic uplift. There's a greater middle class. There's greater ability to have time to relax and to have disposable income, to use that income to maybe spend the weekend on the coast and with your family. So this is partly also responding to the change in the socioeconomic makeup of the country.
The project encompasses three main components. Marina Town, which anchors the project as a dynamic hub of living, leisure, and exchange. Waterfront pavilions that extend the public realm into the sea's embrace, and a hospitality cluster introducing boutique hotels and short-stay lodgings.
The whole project has a considerable amount of land. I think that total is about 20 hectares, which is a lot along the coast. But it's being done in phases, and the first phase is quite compact and small. It's about less than 6 hectares. And I say compact because within those 6 hectares, we are designing a fully self-sustaining, multifunctional town that has almost everything at a small, reduced, compact scale. So there's housing, different types of housing, villas, apartments, terrace housing. There's places to shop, so commerce. There's places to eat, different types of restaurants, more bars, more casual, more a little bit more of a formal place. There's also a club that doubles as a co-working space so people can be there over the course of a week and help host meetings, host more like corporate events type thing. There's more recreational amenities, of course, like you might imagine pool club and jogging and places to push a stroller if when you're with your family. And so the focus has been on making it pedestrian friendly and really trying to diminish the scale and make it something that is humane in terms of human scale. By that, it means that you're not privileging machines, cars, or any other all the other machines that you might need to keep this place working, such as water treatment plants and generators, all of which we are designing, but those are all sort of being pushed as far away from the area where the humans are as possible to make it a place where it's about communing with nature and with water. We spend a lot of time thinking about walkways and paths and places where you can sit and sit near a tree and walk by a canal. So all of that sort of human-based infrastructure at a very, very small scale has been woven into what is big, but it's meant to feel small.
Central to the shoreside at Nahwin's design is Casa Architects' philosophy as a firm, imbuing environmental science, landscape architecture, and urban design into the fabric of the project.
I didn't study architecture at first. I did philosophy and environmental science. And that got me into architecture through the back door. And I was interested in philosophy, hence the concepts we have about places, and environmental science, hence like people like Alexander von Humboldt, I was interested in ecology and how those affect how we ultimately treat our planet. And because of that, when I got into architecture school, I was always curious about urban design and landscape. So in fact, the school I went to had a landscape architecture program and had an urban design program. And although I had applied to the architecture school and I ended up getting a degree in architecture, I did spend like half my time looking into the landscape architecture and peering into the urban design and taking classes as much as I could in those two other faculties and departments. So I was really always interested in that. And then when I actually got out of school, my first few jobs were in urban design and in landscape architecture. I practiced in a landscape architecture office. In fact, I even taught landscape architecture for a bit, for a couple of years right out of school. So I always have tried to keep those two interests alive. And when we founded Casa about now almost 18 years ago, I always knew I wanted to try to get into urban design and find work in that sphere. It's not easy and it's not usual, but I think successfully been able to cultivate those clients. And also from a leadership standpoint, most of the research that we do in the office in terms of the books we write and the white papers we publish have usually been in that domain of urban and landscape. So that also allows us to keep that flame sort of up burning.
With the ocean at its doorstep, the project's planning prioritized hydrology, native ecology, and circulation as interdependent systems shaping the site's overall form.
Number one, hydrology. So really how water moves on the site. Really important, especially a coastal project like this, especially a coastal project in an area in the world that receives what is called super typhoons, which are basically like super hurricanes. In fact, there's one that just grazed the northern part of the Philippines right now, as we speak, 165 miles an hour winds type thing. I mean, this is the reality of building here. So understanding how water moves, both from the ocean, but also from the land. In other words, from the front and from the back, because water moves in both plays both directions. And you got to think about the flow of water, capturing, not capturing, moving, you know, retaining all of that, the whole hydrological process, number one. Number two, the vegetative process or the vegetative assets. In other words, the green stuff that's on the site. That, of course, complements the blue. I call it blue-green. But looking at existing trees, looking at native species that can be reintroduced, looking at how you can utilize riparian corridors, in other words, areas where you have ecologies that are in the kind of wetland zone to help stabilize certain edges and hold earth in ways that are softer rather than harder. So looking at just all of the green technologies from the site planning perspective. And then the third is circulation and movement that has to do with, and not just, of course, vehicles. I think most people think circulation is just moving cars, but it's not at all. And I think we got to think about the post-car world. In fact, in this project, at one point, the client said, we don't want any cars. or at least there was a couple of clients of the consortium said, we want no cars in the project. And of course, that was, it's like, well, how can we do that? Is that realistic? Is it all e-vehicles? And, you know, having this debate now, 2025, seems early, but I think in 5 years, this debate will be very, very serious in terms of automated vehicles, how much cars do you need, but also other forms of circulation. You know, the widths of paths, bikes, walkers, pedestrians, smaller vehicles, if they're what we call automated vehicles, and how you plan them, how you move them, the difference between
larger thoroughfares, smaller, where the service vehicles are. And a project like this, of course, has roads that are, or maybe access points that are just about getting the trash out or bringing utilities in and maintaining the project as opposed to arriving as a visitor. So managing all of that circulation logistics, I would say, the third important part.
Developing along the coastline demanded close coordination with consultants to integrate MEP access and utilities essential to sustaining a new self-contained waterfront community.
If you compare it to the grand scheme of level of remoteness in the Philippines, given that you have 7,000 islands in this archipelago in the Pacific, it's not as remote as you could get. There are places that are even harder, farther, and more challenging to build in that we're actually working on and for other projects. But it's still, so it is 3 hours from the capital, and it's accessible by road, and there is a highway. And so, you know, you can get building materials there. Having said that, there's a lot of challenges regarding utilities, water treatment, energy, high-speed internet, which are all important aspects to the functioning of the town. So we've had to bring in consultants and engineers to essentially create a series of mini micro utility plants on the site to treat our own water, to handle our own energy, essentially to have a kind of redundancy, the planning for potential failures, because there are local providers of water, energy, and other utility lines that you can, that you could rely on, but they're not entirely dependable. So you're in order to have this project viable, you basically have to design in resiliency planning for potential mishaps in that system. And so that has been a pretty important part of the project from an engineering point perspective, yes.
While the permitting process shared similarities with U.S. coastal contexts like Florida and California, the collaboration of local partners was vital in addressing the distinct environmental and cultural conditions of the Philippines.
On one hand, at the macro level, in other words, seen from 30,000 feet, it looks like it's not too different in the sense that, you know, a lot of the codes now have been standardized at an international level. A place like the Philippines, for example, when it comes to seismic codes, because earthquakes are pretty important, have adopted codes that are very similar to a place like California. And so, you know, so they're kind of fashioned around codes that we would know. And when it comes to, let's say, building products that have to do with weather and climate, a place like the Philippines would not be too different from a place like Florida, where you have heat and you have hurricanes. So, and the building purveyors and building suppliers know that. And so they start to look at markets that are kind of related. But I think at the micro level, of course, there's lots of nuance and differences in terms of the processing and the different steps and the permitting. And this is why it's critical in any place to have local partners. There's no way we could do this remotely only by ourselves. You always, any place we go to, one of the critical questions is, who do we collaborate with? And is that collaboration one that is productive and that we're happy with? Because if you don't, it's kind of it can be a disaster.
The master plan unfolds as a series of terraces that follow the site's natural contours, embedding buildings within pockets of landscape that cascade gently toward the bay. Before the architectural design could take place, a complex plan to control storm surges and water management needed to be implemented.
Stormwater management would be part number one. Number two is oceanfront development. And the third would be on-site surface water runoff. So we knew right from the bat that the site as it stands today gets flooded when there is a storm, Of course, it tends to be an intense storm, but, you know, maybe every 10 years, about the first 20 feet, 30 feet of the site will experience flooding when big waves come. And that can get more and more and more intense, and will get more and more intense because of all the factors that we're aware of. And so the first thing we did straight right away, before we even got into the architecture of any of the buildings, was a detailed regrading analysis and planning exercise, where we essentially, through drone mapping, got a very precise topographical contour map of both the site, the land site, but also what's called the bathymetry. I always mispronounce that word, but I think I pronounce it correct, which is essentially the topography of the water underneath. And so we got these amazing plans to 10 centimeters of a level of precision of all of the topography on site, but also all the topography underwater. And the first exercise was for us to begin to re-terrace the site, essentially to move and regrade the land so that we are controlling storm surge and managing storm water to its maximum minimum. In other words, as minimal of the site that we could be exposed to water flood. So right now, we've basically brought it down to just the park promenade. So only in a 100-year flood, only the recreation zones, which are the area where you might jog or you might push a stroller, is what would get exposed to a 100-year flood. But all of the buildings and anything with interior outfitting surfaces, the restaurant, and especially the homes, all of the residential are treated like sacred pieces that have been lifted by about almost, if I'm not mistaken, about almost 4 meters, which is more than 10 feet. Which, just to put it in line, you know, here in New York, after Hurricane Sandy, FEMA increased the 100-year flood line by, I think, about 8.5 feet, which is almost 3 meters. In other words, all of the structures along the waterfront in Manhattan, for example, you know, this, because actually my wife is an architect who specializes in, one of her specialties is flood management in New York, and she works for New York City EDC. And they do a lot of work with FEMA in terms of flood resiliency, is basically moving these buildings either up or moving their utility infrastructure up or protecting them. If you're a hospital, for example, there's a couple of hospitals, NYU and Bellevue Hospital, which are along the East River, which experienced massive flooding during Hurricane Sandy, and they've had to do a lot of work to get above that 9-foot line. So that's the first thing that we did. And now I realize that two other parts of the answer. The second one is oceanfront development. Basically means that any part of the building needs to be, and even the landscape, I think this is also what you're getting at, is going to be exposed to a high degree of salt spray and wind exposure and UV exposure, because of the intensity of the sun, and that does extreme damage to buildings, and it's very harsh to certain plants. Certain plants work well because they were brought up and are native to this environment, but if you try to put something that doesn't work with that environment, it'll die. And the same with buildings, they will corrode. And so in terms of the choice of materials, both hard and soft, has been always guided by that principle of understanding that it will be exposed to that ocean environment, which is very specific and intense. And then the third is that in addition to the water coming from the ocean, which is salty water during a surge, you also have the rain, which is coming from the top, either in from the sky or from the mountains, because there actually are, behind this site, there are some steep slopes that will bring runoff surface water down. So the other critical part of the design was creating a series of channels, culverts, waterways that ensured porosity and water movement and retention ponds throughout the project. So all of the buildings essentially sort of tiptoe and ballet around these canals because the first thing that we designed were the canals. In fact, the architecture came second. It was the first move was the terraces and the canals. So really it was the landscape first, and the architecture had to sort of play and adapt to itself, adapt to those that design.
The waterfront promenade merges commercial energy with a relaxed coastal rhythm that simultaneously embraces outdoor activities, cafes spilling into shaded arcades, shops, and co-working spaces stitched together by courtyards and gardens.
It's meant to be a place to be outside. Clients were very also adamant and excited about ensuring a plethora of outdoor type of activities. So on the land side, there's all kinds of sports stuff, that both active and passive, jogging paths, tennis courts, volleyball courts, paddle tennis, all for things like that that are kind of integrated. In fact, one of the clients is a big tennis player, and we were able to, going back to this question about circulation, we were able to sneak in a 200 parking car garage to the site by slipping it into the mountain so you don't even see it, and utilizing the terraces. And above that garage are tennis courts. So when you drive down the hill, one of the first things you see are 6 tennis courts, and those tennis courts are really just the roof of a hidden parking garage that's kind of tucked into the mountain. So there are all kinds of activities like that that are meant to be about an active, healthy lifestyle. Then, of course, there's water. And then the water activities are meant to be the real destination, the draw. So there is almost a 2-kilometer long waterfront park. And along that waterfront park, and it's like a promenade, are different outdoor amenities and activities, from more marina-based things like kayak launches, boat docks, things where you can literally go into the water with some sort of water-based vehicle, or more passive experiences with water, such as different floating pools. So there is sort of a partially salt pool, a salt fresh pool, a fresh pool built into the promenade, or what's called the embankment. And throughout that waterfront park, there's a pool club that's more sort of adults oriented. There's something that you might see in a place like Ibiza, or Bali. Then there's more of a family oriented pool club that has play equipment for the children along, and with a little school that's meant to also be a place where they can have outdoor classrooms and learn about how the water is being restored, because there's a big restoration in that bathymetry area that I mentioned, that the underwater, the project also is basically rebuilding the coral reefs and replanting the mangroves. So all of that waterfront ecological restoration is meant to be part of a kind of demonstration project for children and for teaching. And then there are other recreational things along the water, such as outdoor markets that are meant to be programmed across a 7-day cycle. So maybe a pop-up market, craft, farmer's market. So we designed an outdoor structure for that. There are a series of dining options. There are a couple of restaurants, ranging from places where you can show up in your flip-flops to more of a bar to more of a sit-down area with white tablecloths. So there's a range of eating places. And then there are two sort of iconic structures, which are the yacht club that has a couple of stores. And it's not exclusive to just the yacht club members. There's a yacht club area that feels more like almost like an airline VIP lounge that would be for yacht club members. But up and below that, in other words, below and above that, is a outdoor promenade and a casual dining area for people along the promenade, where you can just pick up sandwiches and eat outside looking at the boats. And then at the very, very tip of the marina, there's something we call a beacon. And that was also another idea from the client, to create a kind of vertical structure that stands out, that almost pays homage to lighthouses. These are always important parts of marina towns across the world, even since Alexandria and Egypt. And it's meant to be I've always wanted to design one of these. And so we're finally designing one, which is a camera obscura. They're very low-tech medieval, they're really from the medieval period, which is just basically a black room with a little hole, and you can see the outside pictured on certain surfaces depending on how you design that little hole. So this beacon will actually have a couple of these camera obscuras where you, as you walk or take the elevator up, you can see the outside projected on the inside of a room. And then, of course, that beacon is illuminated at night and becomes kind of like a big monument and a landmark.
The iconic yacht club, composed of five pyramidal forms rising above the marina, acts as both a landmark and an extension of the landscape, its faceted geometry mirroring the coastal waves.
The yacht club was really inspired by the shape of a wave. We looked a lot at how waves curl and how they create volume and space on the inside. The yacht club essentially kind of mimics this notion of a wave with a series of screens like slats and louvers. Right now we're considering a number of materials, of course, because of its oceanfront reality. We're sort of looking at durability of these, what the slats would be, whether they're composite, hybrid, bamboo, mass bamboo type of applications. And then on the inside of that screen, we have a series of ETFE panels, which are basically a polymer that is non-petroleum based. So it's a kind of eco-plastic, you might call it, that can be single ply or double ply. In other words, it can be like a pillow or it can be just like a sheet. And that's a translucent material that allows the light in, but also is great to protect the structure from winds and rain. And so that is essentially the enclosure. And then on the inside, it's a combination of steel and concrete as it changes from the lower area is reinforced concrete in order to stabilize it and ensure that in the event of any water exposure, it's protected. And then above that line is steel, and also to lighten the structure.
Further extending into the design of the built program are oceanic motifs such as the curve of surfboards, underwater flora, and aquatic creatures.
The restaurant and market pool club, which are little sort of cluster of buildings right on the water, are all kind of interesting. They all are related because of their formal similarity to a surfboard, you might say. So they've, although the first one that might appear very surfboard-like is the restaurant. Very much it's like a giant surfboard. But all the other, the pool club and the market are designed as agglomerations of surfboards. So we're inspired by how sometimes when you go to the beach, you see a bunch of surfboards lined up along the rocks or the cliff, and how that repetition of that shape could become a vertical element, almost like a column. So in the pool club and the market, we essentially use that shape as the column. It's a mix between a steel member in the middle of the surfboard, what sometimes in surfboard language is called a stringer, which is like the wood piece. And then around that is glass reinforced concrete to make it a lighter element. And then that holds together a series of shapeboard looking canopies, which are built in a combination of steel as the edge beam with ETFE panels or ETFE fabrics, single ply, not the double ply, like in the rest or in the yacht club, because single ply is less expensive. It's also quite well suited if you're not doing a curved surface, but you're just doing something that's a single curvature, so it's not a complex curve. And in those, in the pool club and in the market, they're pretty simple roofs. So that's where we're using the ETFE, and that's almost like a kind of tent structure that's stretched in tensegrity or like in tension. On our mood board for the project, there's sailboats, there are waves, and there are surfboards and kayaks. So we're essentially always looking at ocean-related structures, in addition to, I have to confess, also ocean organisms. A lot of our design inspiration was also looking at pictures from scuba divers, what they see underwater. So we looked at, you know, maybe some of the structures might even look a little bit like sea anemones or sea
one of my favorite ones that we found were called nudie branches, which are these little sea sponges, super colorful, beautiful if you look them online. And they're sometimes about 6 or 8 inches long, but they look like these extraterrestrial sea things, the incredible shapes and colors, beautiful. So we were definitely inspired by all of those ocean-related things.
Materials are drawn from the local palette like stone, timber, and textured plaster, imbuing the architecture with warmth and continuity against the shifting blues of the sea.
First of all, as mentioned, the ocean reality is top of mind and was the first sort of decision-making criteria to be able to determine whether a material is viable or not. So that's how we are able to edit out yes or no. But then the other thing that was very important in choosing materials was to determine whether it's going to be exposed or not to water, potential water, and what kind of water. So we looked at the degree of exposure that might have to ocean water, the degree of exposure might have to fresh water due to the rain, and then those areas that maybe would have very limited exposure. So we sort of graded the project based on that. And then the other important design criteria is, given that we not only did the urban design for the whole town, but we're designing all the buildings from the residential to these communal amenities, we have to have a palette that is consistent but not repetitive and monotonous. So that was also really important. And trying to find a material, let's say, menu that can tie the whole thing together so they do feel like there is consistency. And when you look at the images, it's like, oh, these are family of buildings that are all related, but they're not the same. And we don't want every building to look like the next one either. So that was probably one of the biggest design challenges, is to create this family of forms that are related, like in a family of humans that, okay, I see your cousin, I see your sister, you guys have similar traits, but you're not the same. So we looked at, for example, you know, from a structural point of view, we ended up zeroing in on a hybrid structure of reinforced concrete, steel, with occasional use of mass bamboo on the interior. Again, that had to do with exposure to water, anything that utilizes glue, such as cross-laminated timber. There was concern that it might not really do well over a long period of time when exposed to these elements. So when we utilize that material, it's on the inside. Like in the restaurant, for example, we transition from concrete at a certain level, from 0 to, let's say, 6 feet, and then steel, and then for the roof beams, mass bamboo. There's an amazing company that we discovered is the first one of the pioneers of mass bamboo in the world, and they're actually based in the Philippines. They have a 5,000 hectare farm of the largest bamboos in the world, and they are a vertically integrated company that they do all their own farming, their own milling, their own fabrication, and then they deliver these things. So that was the structural side. And then from the cladding, we, you know, at some point had considered some more natural material, but ultimately we really had to do composites because of the degree of exposure. So we have, you know, eco-plastic louvers and battens that mimic the look of, let's say, bamboo or wood screen for the sheathing. We have expanded metal, which is very pliable type of metal. It's also quite affordable. It stretches. You can customize the openings that have this sort of diamond shape, and it's, you know, it can be powder coated with several layers of factory applied paint that is ocean grade. So in fact, it's used a lot in boats. So we really had to always put the ocean environment at front and center in the choice of materials.
Looking ahead, a hospitality cluster expands the master plan, introducing boutique hotels and short-stay accommodations that further strengthen tourism and cultural exchange. but at the moment, construction is in the civic works phase.
It's meant to be a community at first. There are, in the second phases, hotels being planned, but this first phase that you see in the pictures and this 6 hectares that I mentioned that is really based around the marina is really community driven. Of course, not that tourists can come, and maybe people who own apartments might put them on Airbnb and rent them out or something, but it's not driven towards tourism, which also is a big change and different. I mean, if you look at most of the water-based developments that have been implemented and built in the Philippines in the last 5 years, primarily they're tourism-oriented. They're geared towards foreigners who come, and of course, foreigners, whether you're Australian, American, or coming from Singapore or Hong Kong, you are looking at the Philippines as a beautiful tropical destination. So you go there for 3-4 days and you're on holiday. This is a little different. This is really meant more as a community where people would come here, either live here or it might be a second home. And once the vision that the owners have is once it becomes a community destination, then tourists will want to see it. Just like they were thinking of a lot of the famous marina towns along the Mediterranean where, you know, maybe a place like Positano or in Italy where, you know, it is a community. But then tourists go because you actually are drawn by the community. You're like, oh, this is a wonderful little town along the Greek coast or something. So that was sort of the logic. And they are doing construction as we speak, but it is the civil works. In other words, utilities, roads, retaining walls, regrading, all that first design stuff that I mentioned before the buildings. The buildings most likely won't begin construction until next year. Perhaps third to fourth quarter of next year, because there's a considerable amount of civil works that has to get put in place. But we're working on all the construction documents and all of the engineering in order for it to be sort of shovel ready once the site is ready. But because the site is, as you've noticed, it's quite remote and as you noted, it's still also quite vegetated, there has to be done with some sort of degree of care and caution.
For Carlos, attention to the smallest details remains paramount, even on a project of this scale, ensuring that every element is carefully considered.
Details matter. Even at a big project like this, where there's so many complex moving parts, and it seems like it's about the big moves, ultimately where the rubber hits the road, so to speak, is at the detail scale. And so where you make the resolutions and where you bring in the design intelligence is at the detail scale, at the building scale in terms of how a building lands or how a building facade works, but also at a urban and landscape scale in terms of how are we treating the transition between a canal, a pedestrian sidewalk, and the entry to a villa or to a house. And I think all of those little details and transitions say a lot. And so, for example, in this project, one of the things that we really, really wanted to avoid was walls. We didn't want to create any gates, any enclosures, any hard boundaries between places. But at the same time, you need to deal with privacy. And so this is a public town. People can arrive and park in the parking lot and walk to the... So how do you manage the boundary between a house and the public space without putting a wall in the gate? I think there are many ways you can do it, with landscape hedges and with a water separation that cues people like, oh, that's not, I shouldn't go there. You know, that's not a public space. I should walk here, without having to be really too rough and exact. But that just has to do with spending time designing the details.
The shoreside at Nawan forms a cohesive vision, a maritime village reborn through architectural choreography, where every terrace, pavilion, and promenade strengthens the dialogue between nature, community, and the sea. Before we close out this episode, I always try to gain some additional insight from our guests about the greater industry. Casa Architects emphasizes using data-driven studies, research, and quantitative analysis for their projects. I was curious what advice Carlos would give to other architects interested in a more analytical process for project planning.
What I believe is being an expert is sometimes detrimental to design, and that we should approach every project a little bit like a beginner. Of course, that I don't mean to be naive about that either, but in terms of walking into a room or walking into a site or walking in and meeting a client and assuming you know nothing and collecting as much data as you can about them, about the place, about all the other parameters that will affect your project, and being as kind of voracious and omnivorous as you can about that data collection, not leaving any stone unturned, but also just, you know, nowadays, frankly, there's so much data you can get on any project, any site, any client, that it could be overwhelming, but allowing that early fishing expedition to be very rich and, let's say, fecund in terms of fertile, and just and then sifting to that and say, when not having precepts yet, and allowing some of this data to drive your insights and what the sort of connections you see. So this is a sort of loose period where you're analyzing it and, of course, balancing it on things that you already know, what the clients are asking for, what the stakeholders are telling you is critical to the project, but also listening to that, the numbers to drive a design. Because I think design can be a form of thinking, but if it's unfettered from a kind of stylistic requirement that it has to look in a particular way or has to be a particular thing. I think if you say that we don't really know yet, I mean, leaving that open allows that data-driven process to be facilitated and to be a creative one.
I really enjoyed this conversation with Carlos. I hope this episode sparks a new idea, helps you solve a problem that you've been working through, or inspires the mark that you want to leave on this world.
I've been interested in this topic of beauty. And it's beauty is a very slippery term. And I don't talk about it because as soon as you say it, people have so many different reactions to it and it's all over the board. And it could be like cosmetic beauty and classical beauty. What do you mean about beauty? It's like, wow, you know, this is, don't even begin, open that Pandora's box. But I'm interested, because of my background in philosophy, I'm interested about how philosophers have talked about beauty as having this ability to kind of awaken your senses as a human. And many philosophers also talk about it not just as a self-awareness or a sort of something about self-actualization, but it also has to do with you connecting with the world and connecting with your people and people around you and becoming just more here and more there. And I think that in a sort of hopeful way, if one could think about architecture or design as a cautious, slow discipline where we're building things that we hope will have a positive impact. That positivity many times comes from beauty and how beauty can make people stop and think and look and maybe listen and maybe pay attention, all of those together. I know it sounds very sort of warm and fuzzy and hard to pin down, but there is, you know, there's been a lot of research into this in terms of, even from a scientific point of view, how awe in people inspires, you know, better ability to be aware of their environment and to be better actually to listen to people in their community. So I think, yeah, that would be hopefully a contribution that some of these structures somewhere in the world maybe allow, you know, enable us to experience this little burst of joy, which is what beauty is. And through that burst of joy, focus on each other in, or on our place, or on what we're seeing in more heightened, attentive way.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, visit rcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around rcat.com. For over 30 years, RCAT has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try RCAT and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. Visit rcat.com. That's ARCAT.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing this with your friends. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back to share more stories and lessons learned to help you navigate your next project.